Hold on, I got a woman and a kid 200 yards out moving towards the convoy. Her arms aren't swinging, she's carrying something. Yeah, she's got a grenade. She's got an RKG Russian grenade. She's saying to the kid.
You say a woman and a kid?
You got eyes on this? Can you confirm?
Negative. Your call.
They fry you if you're wrong.
From Tuscaloosa, Alabama, this is Aspect Radio. I'm Corey Kraft.
And I'm Ben Flanagan. Welcome to another episode. Corey, a lot's happened since we last recorded and we predicted the Oscar nominations.
A lot has happened.
We were right about a lot, and we missed out on a couple. We had mentioned that there was this new Clint Eastwood movie that was sneaking up on the race and could rear its head and change the game and shake things up in this year's Oscar race, and it turns out it may just have done that. But even though American Sniper missed out on Best Director in a bit of a surprise, I guess, after Clint Eastwood scored a DGA nomination, it did get 6 nominations, including Best Picture. And what has now become its sort of Oscar adversary, even though neither of these movies necessarily are considered the frontrunner to win Best Picture, the film Selma only scored 2 nominations, 1 for Best Song and 1, yes, for Best Picture. I believe we had that, Corey. So at this point, you would think that Selma and American Sniper would be these two movies just kind of doing their own thing, and nobody would necessarily connect the two. But now that they've been released, and now that these Oscar nominations have played out in the way that they have, there are people out there who are linking them together and pitting them against each other in ways that we've seen in the past, but to me, this is a little unusual, and we can frame this Oscar narrative maybe a little later on, but I think it's more important that we talk about the films themselves, because unlike some people, we've actually seen both of these movies.
Yes.
And I want to start with American Sniper. There are people out there who generally like this movie. It seems like the public especially does. This movie has, in a huge surprise to even us, become a behemoth at the box office.
Yeah, if there's an undisputed box office champion between the two of these movies, it's clearly American Sniper, which by the time this episode comes out may have grossed upwards of $200 million domestically, which is just mind-boggling.
2 weeks of wide release. Too. These are like Avatar or Dark Knight numbers. I mean, this is insane.
Yeah.
Nobody saw this coming. I mean, you said on this show, we thought it was going to be a hit and we thought it would do well, but I'm going to the Cobb here in Tuscaloosa and it's as if Harry Potter, Hunger Games, and whatever new James Cameron movie combined have come out. I mean, the place is just full and it's sold out. You can't get a ticket to it. So who knows why? It's just become a cultural phenomenon overnight. It has elements like Clint Eastwood being the director, even though he's not in the movie. Bradley Cooper's a big star, has been at the forefront of the marketing of this, is a producer, and is very passionate about it. And the movie is called American Sniper, which is an amazing title, especially if you're a marketer for Warner Brothers, who released this movie. And then it has this story, which is appealing to Americans in general, of Chris Kyle, the former Navy SEAL who is considered in the record books, I guess now, in American history, the most lethal sniper ever. A war in Iraq veteran who wrote a book called American Sniper on which this film is based. There are people out there, the main criticism it seems, Corey, that this film lacks nuance in terms of how it depicts the war in Iraq, how it depicts the veterans' experience, and how it depicts Muslims. People see them as only villains in this movie, and people think that that is strictly how Clint Eastwood depicted them here, and perhaps how Chris Kyle depicted them in his book of the same title. So, do you agree with the people who criticized the movie for that lack of nuance, or do you find any in it where people seem to miss it?
I think the movie wants to think that it is a nuanced examination of many of these issues, that it does not just present a black and white view of the world, of good versus evil, that it actually takes time and takes an opportunity to sort of morally investigate the violent but necessary and morally justifiable actions of Chris Kyle, the protagonist here. While I think American Sniper mostly works, I don't think it really is more complicated a story of good versus evil than many of the classic westerns that Clint Eastwood starred in early in his career and made a career of as director, sort of subverting and sort of bringing new light to. In movies like Unforgiven, for example, his western masterpiece, the winner of the Best Picture Academy Award, it takes a new look at sort of the anti-heroic gunslinger and the cost of violence on a person's soul. And I want to think that American Sniper thinks it is doing that, but I do not think the movie is particularly successful at that. What I think it is successful at is really its great lead performance. I think Bradley Cooper is terrific in this movie, and I think that whatever weight this movie carries is borne by his widened shoulders as he bulked up to play this character of Chris Kyle. But the movie itself and the situations in which Kyle finds himself are generally free of nuance. I would say that it is hard to take a movie seriously that purports to be about the moral cost of even justifiable violence when the targets of said violence are all to a person bloodthirsty murderers who would just as soon put a drill through a child's head, which is a thing that happens, as anything else. You know, when your options are that guy lives or I guess I'll shoot him, I mean, that's kind of a straw man argument, don't you think? Like, well, of course you'd shoot him, and why would you feel bad about it? It sets up a false dichotomy that I think is kind of dishonest to the legacy of many men and women who fought overseas and who had to make perhaps legitimately difficult choices. Apart from that, one significant part of Chris Kyle's life is, as briefly depicted in the end of the film and kind of throughout in these Hurt Locker-like scenes between deployments, sort of the story of readjustment. If you're over there and you do these things that take a terrible cost on your soul, how can you come back to the real world, to normal life? And the movie seems to suggest the answer to that is, well, you know, just kind of think about it for a minute and you'll feel better. I don't really get a sense of what seems to be a very real problem of post-traumatic stress disorder in Chris Kyle as a person, even though the film sets up that toward the end of his life, historical spoiler alert, he dedicated his career to helping veterans suffering from that disease. I mean, the movie seems to indicate that he himself is troubled, but it's nothing that a little, you know, good old-fashioned manly Americana can't fix on the part of Chris Kyle. And I think that's kind of an odd thing to say. You know, why can Chris Kyle sort of shake off the PTSD and so many other people can't? The movie mostly works. It mostly works as an action entertainment with a very fine lead performance. And Clint Eastwood as a director, barring a couple just astoundingly lazy directorial choices, mostly seems engaged in a way that he hasn't recently. But there are just still so many odd things this movie does, odd things it says, even if it doesn't realize it's saying them, even if it thinks it's saying something a little bit more complex, that just makes it so that I can't really fully embrace this.
I don't know that I fully embraced the movie, but it's not because of the lack of nuance, because I feel like I'm finding more subtlety in it than its harshest critics, not necessarily including yourself, but I mean, you've laid it out there that it does fail to capture the nuance of post-traumatic stress disorder, especially in the case of Chris Kyle, and the severity of what he may have suffered personally and how difficult it might have been for him to reacclimate to the States and his life as a family man. But I see it, actually. I think that this movie is all about PTSD and all about the severity of the toll that war and violence takes on the young men and women who serve and the difficulty that they have readjusting to so-called normal life in the United States. And Bradley Cooper is good at communicating that for sure, but I think Eastwood deserves credit for raising these questions and paying attention to what really matters here. And the movie comes across as something whose sole purpose is simply to deify a human being and tell the story of an American hero. And I think that on the surface, that's true. And we see Chris Kyle doing what Chris Kyle did, being the biggest badass in the legend, as he's called in the movie, in the history of the Navy SEALs. But there are moments even when he's in Iraq and in the midst of this action movie format that you mentioned, because in many ways this is an action movie, and this is stuff that we haven't necessarily seen Eastwood do as a director in terms of scale and choreography and set pieces. It's something new, and I think that a lot of the action is really exciting and well-framed. But I think what is at work here, though, is all of the violence that you see is taking a huge toll on Chris Kyle. And we see that when he comes back and he's not the same person that he once was with his wife, played by Sienna Miller in a good performance, and his children, obviously. He's struggling, and there are people just like him who are struggling. And I don't want to get too specific about what happens, obviously, within the movie. People know historically what happens, but along with the toll that the war takes on him and others, this movie is also about the dangers of gun culture and involving yourself as a hobbyist in that culture and what it can lead to. And I don't think Clint Eastwood is painting that in a very positive light.
I don't see that.
I do totally. It's all throughout the movie. I mean, you talk about Chris Kyle, a guy who has owned a gun for his entire life, right? And he has used it in some capacity since he was a child. There's an early scene in the film where he's hunting with his father, and he shoots a deer, and Chris Kyle drops his gun on the ground to approach the deer, and his dad chastises him for leaving his weapon on the ground and stresses how important this tool is to him as he'll grow up and become a man. And then we get this whole scene about what kind of man are you going to be? Are you going to be a wolf? Are you going to be a sheep? Are you going to be a sheepdog?
That's a terrible scene.
Yeah, it's kind of awkward. And that's kind of the Eastwood that we've gotten for the past several years. That scene has zero nuance whatsoever. I mean, it's totally in your face about the theme that we're going to completely squash into the ground until you get it. It doesn't take much. But the emphasis they put on PTSD, say, towards the end of the film, I don't think that Chris Kyle necessarily makes the transition as easily as you suggest, because there is a sequence where he meets with a psychologist, and they talk about how he is having trouble getting back to the real world and coming to grips with who he is over here in the States. He mentions that his biggest regret, it's not the things that he has seen, it's not the things that he's done over there and the people that he's killed. It's the fact that the only regret that he has are the people he couldn't save while he was a sniper.
Would you be surprised if I told you that the Navy has credited you with over 160 kills? Do you ever think that you might have seen things or done some things over there that you wish you hadn't?
Oh, that's not me, no.
What's not you?
I was just protecting my guys. They were trying to kill our soldiers, and I'm willing to meet my creator and answer for every shot that I took. The thing that haunts me are all the guys that I couldn't save. I'm willing and able to be there, but I'm not. I'm here. I quit.
You can walk down any hall in this hospital. We got plenty of soldiers need saving.
Mm-hmm.
Want to take a walk?
Sure.
Again, this is surface level language here, and I don't think that this is getting to the bottom of what's really wrong with him. And I think that the doctor there sees that. I think he sees right through what Chris Kyle is saying, and he might think that, but the violence has obviously taken a toll on him and what he's done. I mean, there are two separate sequences that involve him having to possibly shoot a child.
Yes.
In the movie. One at the beginning and one towards the end. Well, and those are completely different scenes. And yeah, there are things in his life that have happened that have changed him and have changed his hesitation in what he does as a sniper. So I think that it totally speaks to that. Again, when he's talking to this doctor helps him figure out how he can get over what he has, his own problems and his own PTSD, how he can save other people who are struggling with the same thing. So it totally addresses that.
I think you're being very generous to a movie, though, that ends 15 minutes or less after that scene. An extended epilogue or more of an emphasis on that course of healing would have strengthened the movie considerably, because perhaps that is the intention, but what it comes across as is he has a talk with a psychiatrist, he goes shooting with some other veterans, and, well, he's doing pretty well.
He's doing okay, but he's also still involved in, again, gun culture.
I don't know that I buy this movie even as an implicit critique of gun culture, because he's so, I mean, like you said, he's sort of born into it from such a young age. It becomes a central part of his life and his identity. And it is his tool by which this movie suggests he became an American hero.
Right. And how he helped others too.
Yes, and helped others selflessly on the battlefield and later off the battlefield.
Right.
There is an irony in what happens to him, what did historically happen to him, that the movie does not engage. Again, I think considering the solemnity of this film's ending, I think that, you know, the last 15 minutes of this movie are super clunky. They are super ineffective, and we sort of blend some documentary footage into the film in the credits that add to this idea of solemnity that I don't think the movie earns it. I don't think that the movie does enough with his character after the war, or after he's done with the war, to say, well, he got a little better and he worked out many of his issues by helping these people, and then something pretty tragically ironic happens. But the point is, the movie traffics in and dwells on his heroism on the battlefield rather than off the battlefield. I feel like if there had been more of a balance, then maybe some of what you're saying could have been clearer. I don't see it.
Well,
there.
You mentioned that the last 15 minutes are clunky, and yes, maybe they could have spent more time on how he became a public figure.
Right.
In terms of helping people with this problem and also telling his story. He was a celebrity. He was appearing on talk shows, on cable news.
Got
everybody
sued for libel by Jesse Ventura.
Everybody knew who he was. And that this doesn't really address that. I mean, everybody within the military knows who he is. But there's a scene at the very end of the movie that I think tells the whole story. And the scene starts out with a close-up of a gun that he is playing with, and he is acting out a fun moment and sort of a fantasy with his wife and his kids, and it seems like a very sweet moment for Chris Kyle, and it shows that he has seemingly re-engaged with his wife and children. But I don't think that it's any mistake that the shot starts with the close-up of the gun.
Well, because of what it something significant that happens shortly afterwards.
Yeah, but my point is that yes, you can have good times with them, and you can have fun, and going out to the range can be therapeutic, and you can be a hero on the battlefield, obviously, but there's also danger at the same time, no matter what you're doing and what environment you're in, whether it's on the battlefield and you're incredibly skilled and experienced with that gun and you are a hero with it, but you can get killed just as easily. If you go out to the shooting range, you can have fun and be a hobbyist, but you can get killed just as easily. It's a big part of this movie. I really do.
I don't disagree with you, like, in life, but
I think it's a big part of this movie.
I don't see it. I just don't see that. I think that the movie revels in gun culture. I truly think that. And I think that, I mean, whether or not this is intentional on Eastwood's part, because Eastwood has always had an ambivalent relationship with violence, even as his films have been violent, but I think this film directly equates violence with heroism.
I feel like had Clint Eastwood not spoken at the Republican convention and become kind of a sideshow and become a sort of poster boy for the Republican Party, then people wouldn't feel as strongly about this, and I think that they would recognize the anti-war and anti-violence sentiment that this movie has.
It's just odd, though, that everybody's reading into this movie what they want to see. You want to see it as anti-war? Well, it's anti-war. You want to see it as sort of patriotic, and I don't know that pro-war is the right term, because I don't even think the most patriotic audience member who sees this movie is going to necessarily be pro-war, but certainly supportive in a traditionally conservative manner of the troops. Well, this movie has plenty of that too. It's like a mirror. It just reflects back to you what you bring into it. I mean, to me, the complete lack of a political stance that this movie takes about an extraordinarily hot button topic, I mean, it's kind of Eastwood having his cake and eating it too.
Here's a scene nobody is acknowledging, especially the harsh critics of this movie. When Chris Kyle, and this was an invention, which a lot of this movie has. Yeah, like, there's a lot of invention in it.
This movie does not have a tremendous relationship to truth.
No, that's true, but it's also a film.
Yes, I mean,
you know, so, I mean.
And we'll talk about that when we talk about Selma, sure. I'm sure, but
so there's not a, there's a scene where Chris Kyle is traveling, and he's at an airbase, mm-hmm. and he runs into his brother, who is also an enlisted Marine. It's the first time he's seen him in years.
Yeah.
Chris Kyle has built up this reputation as quote unquote the legend and has become a celebrity within the military. And so things are kind of going well for him as well as they could go overseas and on the battlefield. And when he sees his brother, he sees the exact opposite of that. And he sees the toll that the war has taken on him. And his brother says something very specific to him that suggests that this movie is not celebrating war at all. It is not celebrating the violence that takes place in war. It is definitely, explicitly pointing out the toll that it takes on them during their service and when they come home.
Yeah, I know that scene, and that is a good moment. And maybe I'm bringing some of my own preconceived notions into this, but I kind of read the aftermath of that scene, particularly since it is never really followed up on, is, well, that guy just couldn't take the heat. And luckily, we have guys like Chris Kyle.
I don't see it that way at all. I base that on Chris Kyle's look and the way he absorbs what he just heard from his brother. It's not a look of shame. It's a look of, wow, I'm worried about him. What are we doing
here? Because it's his brother.
Well, his brother has expressed a sentiment that hasn't been thrown around Chris Kyle very often because of the accomplishment that he has overseas and the things that people are feeding him and his ego as the most lethal sniper of all time. And he sees a different perspective in that moment.
Well, there's also another Navy SEAL character later in the film who expresses some ambivalence about the war, which both implicitly and textually, because Chris Kyle says something to this effect afterwards, seems to lead to his death. This ambivalence of, what are we doing here? You know, this character who questions something and then a few scenes later bites it, and then Chris Kyle's like, well, maybe it was because he didn't know what we were doing here.
It's like he just couldn't take it, right?
Right.
But see, I don't read the scene that way because of the perspective of the Sienna Miller character who he says that to and the tragedy that she obviously is acknowledging in that moment. I think Chris Kyle is shell-shocked. And I think that this movie emphasizes that throughout the whole thing. And I think he, in that moment, is using toughness and the fact that he can take it and others can't and his buddy couldn't as a defense mechanism and as a way to cope with that guy's death and the death that he saw and that he has to live with for the rest of his life.
I would like that to be the case.
That's what I see.
I think you're being generous because I don't think that really is communicated effectively. Even if that is the intention, I do not think it's communicated effectively.
Then why am I seeing that? It just seems clear as day. This movie, again, we talk about how it doesn't have a lot of nuance. I don't think it has a lot of nuance in those messages that it's trying to deliver to. Now, in some cases, I really think it does, and I think people are failing to acknowledge that because I think some people have an agenda of rage against this movie, and I think that their politics get in the way.
Well, I think that's fair to say. Yeah. I mean, just like it happened with Zero Dark Thirty.
For sure.
Even though I think Zero Dark Thirty is a much better film.
Oh, it is, and I don't love this movie, okay? This movie is not perfect by any means, and you know I can't promise that it's going to be on any, you know, on any of our lists. Definitely not yours,
no.
But mine either. Towards the end of the year, I think it's entertaining. I think it's pretty well done.
I was entertained.
Yeah, I think it's one of Clint Eastwood's better movies, especially in recent years, for sure. But it's not on the level of The Million Dollar Babies and Unforgivens and the best movies he's made before. And again, I go back to like the actual battlefield and combat sequences that include some of these inventions, including a rival sniper that is toying with the SEALs and Bradley Cooper. None of that really works for me. It creates unnecessary drama and makes it the action movie that it is when it should be dwelling on more of these more subtle themes and heavier topics that it does have and should pay more attention to.
I mean, I guess what it comes down to for me is that while Cooper is very good, Eastwood, as he has been in the last, I don't know, 7-8 years or so, is just so sloppy behind the camera that a lot of this is not, for me, communicated as effectively as it could be. There's just a slackness to the way this film is directed, which is just put the camera somewhere and things will happen in front of it, and then we can all hit the golf course by 1 o'clock today. I mean, I was kind of shocked to see that this film got a best editing Oscar nomination, because if this is among the best editing of the year, then what are we even doing? It's just, there's no momentum to it. It just feels choppy. It just sort of ambles from scene to scene.
I guess the case that they would make is how it goes from deployment to the real world and back and forth between four tours of duty and communicating the story that way and framing it. I don't know. There are perhaps better edited movies in 2014. But I want to touch on one more scene really quickly. Again, how I think that it broaches this topic more so maybe than you. It's when he and his son are at a mechanic, a mechanic's garage. A veteran runs into them and makes a point to approach him and thank him for his service and thank him for saving his life. And he kneels down to Chris Kyle's son to reiterate, "Your father is a hero."
Yeah,
and Eastwood cuts back to Cooper during that scene while this guy is, again, deifying him and singing his praises and building upon the myth of Chris Kyle. And there is a lot of reluctance on the face of Chris Kyle. And
he can't make eye contact with the guy. He's just kind of nodding and going,
Yeah, I think that it speaks to the fact that maybe in that moment he doesn't consider himself a hero.
Excuse me, sir.
Purple?
Are you Chief Chris Kyle?
Yes, sir.
My name is Mads. We met in Fallujah. You saved my life.
I did?
Yes, sir. We were stuck in a house until you came in with the first Marines. You were the one that carried me out.
How are you? You all right? You hold up?
Great. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm just grateful to be alive. Why don't you come down to the VA sometime? The guys would love it. They all know who the legend is.
Yeah, sounds like a good idea.
Hey, okay. Buddy. Your dad? He's a hero. That's right. He saved my life, and he helped me get back to my little girl. So, thank you for lending him to us.
Okay.
I wouldn't be here without him. My family thanks you for your service.
Okay, thank you.
You know, Cooper's really good in that scene. I mean, I think he's great throughout this movie. Like I said, that's this movie's saving grace as a star vehicle for Bradley Cooper. I mean, he couldn't ask for a better one. He, for my money, earned that Oscar nomination because I think he's as good in this film as he's ever been. I just think he's kind of stranded at points by that script, by Eastwood. He really does communicate a lot of what the movie does not really follow up on. You know, it's an instance of perhaps the director and the star not really being in sync with what the subject matter is about. And Cooper's performance belongs in a better movie. It belongs in the once gestating Steven Spielberg version of this
movie. Well, it also has to make you wonder, why did Steven Spielberg decide to leave this behind?
Well, okay, I do want to touch on this, and maybe we could, you know, use this as a segue into talking about some of the other stuff we were going to talk about today. The Chris Kyle is portrayed in this movie, humble, laid back, down to earth, I'm not comfortable with being the center of attention, bears almost no resemblance to the Chris Kyle of reality, who was, if nothing else, quite fond of having the spotlight shown on him, appearing, as you said, on television, writing this autobiography on which this film is based. I don't really want to touch on the veracity of Kyle's own account, though that has been questioned. Some of the things that he wrote about in his book, for example.
I haven't read the book.
Well, personally. I haven't either, but I mean, obviously, as this film becomes an enormous success, the magnifying glass is put on Kyle's life, and people are, you know, sort of picking it apart. And a lot of articles have been written about, and even before this movie, to be fair, about whether or not Chris Kyle was something of a bullshitter who had a tendency to weave a tale that made himself sound great, but whose ultimate truth might not be terribly accurate.
Well, I think a lot of this, too, is coming out of the woodwork in a way now that this movie has as much momentum as it has, especially after it got nominated for Oscars. Pundits out there and people out there who write about the Oscars and have their favorites are disappointed to see that their favorites fell short when American Sniper moved forward, and they use that anger against American Sniper, and suddenly they start pulling every last detail they can find or think of to hurl in a negative direction at this movie to sort of break its momentum.
Well, I think it's worth talking about, though, in that the initial account might not be that close to history.
Right.
And now the film adds other layers, like the sniper character, like so many of the Iraqi characters portrayed in this movie as fairly one-note, violent savages, just sort of layers untruth on top of what may have already been untruth.
Uh-huh.
And I guess the ultimate point is, does that matter? Because we understand, or we should understand, and one can debate whether or not every cinema-goer who has contributed to the nearly $200 million this movie has grossed so far does really kind of take the fact that this is historical fiction to heart, even though we should understand that this does not necessarily bear too much resemblance to reality. But does it matter?
No, it should not matter, I don't think. Because, well, I mean, take something like a film that we love that doesn't carry necessarily the thematic weight in terms of life or death and tragedy and some of the issues we've talked about, but 2010's The Social Network.
Yes.
Which is based on a true story.
Right.
But the figures that it depicts mostly have come out and said, this is not how it happened.
Right. Dramatic license.
Yes. When do we decide that artistic license is okay here, but it's not okay here?
Well, that's, see, and that leads to further controversies that have surrounded so many of the other Oscar-nominated films. The Imitation Game is one, telling the ostensibly true story of Alan Turing in ways that may play up aspects of his personality and downplay other aspects of his personality. Or a movie, and we haven't talked about this, but I don't think you like it as much as I do, a movie like Bennett Miller's Foxcatcher, where so much of the central relationship in that movie seems to be invented to play up the themes that director Bennett Miller wanted to explore.
This happens all the time.
Yeah.
If you want to use a way more extreme example, which, depending on your beliefs, may or may not be true, early in 2014, Darren Aronofsky's Noah, where Christians just threw their hands up in the air and didn't understand the artistic license that he took with the Genesis flood narrative. So this happens all the time, whether it's based on a true story, whether it's based on religious text. It happens. It's a film. It's a narrative. It's historical fiction, as you mentioned. It's meant to tell a story and to entertain you. It's not always meant to find the actual truth of the events that took place.
I'm generally inclined to agree with you, but where I start feeling weird is when a film like American Sniper provokes so many reactions on Twitter and from cinema goers, like, American Sniper made me want to enlist and go shoot some
Muslims.
Well, that's
their problem. That's their problem.
I know it is. Yeah. I know. And I just, I see that and I'm just like, ew.
Right.
It just makes me feel weird. Like, I don't think that's what the movie wanted to inspire.
Okay,
but
you know that. And that should be all that matters, okay? And the people that you respect reading and the people that you like talking about film with, they read the movie the way it's meant to be read or the way that it actually is.
But
I think that the people who decide that they're going to take issue with artistic license this time are the ones who have a problem with American Sniper getting 6 Oscar nominations and making $200 million in 2 weeks just because they don't love the movie.
Well, and we've been talking around perhaps the biggest artistic license controversy of this Academy Awards season, the next movie we're going to talk about, in which the portrayal of Lyndon Baines Johnson and Selma came under fire in the media in what is in all likelihood a fairly calculated attempt to do what it did and affect its chance at getting Oscar nominations.
Before we get to that, and I want to pat ourselves on the back because we got through an entire American Sniper discussion, a long one at that, without mentioning The Fake Baby. We're going to hear from our buddy Craig Hamilton, who has not seen American Sniper, but has a lot to say about it. We'll be right back to talk about Selma.
Craig Hamilton.
And this is
Parting Shot. For any of you out there who follow the movie awards season, that 2 or 3 months that lead up to the Oscar ceremony each year, you don't need me to tell you that it's both controversial and predictable. And there is always some sort of scandal or injustice going on that the pundits and the bloggers like to harp on. It's something to write about, right? Well, this year it's American Sniper. Well, let me back up. It was originally about Ava DuVernay being excluded from the Directors Guild nominations. But now it has mutated into something far different. Ava DuVernay is an African-American woman, and she directed Selma. And many of the pundits and bloggers saw this snub as an affront to its Best Picture chances, and it was. And so, when their film didn't get nominated for Directors Guild, they began an offensive on the movie and the director that ostensibly took its place. That movie being American Sniper, and the director being Clint Eastwood. Now, these experts in the field that complain every year for some injustice are the very ones that are also knowledgeable enough about the Oscars that they should have seen the writing on the wall weeks before when the Producers Guild nominations came out and Selma wasn't on there either. There was no outrage then, only when Clint Eastwood is involved. But here's the kicker. The Oscar nominations were announced a couple of weeks ago, and DuVernay didn't get nominated for Best Director, but neither did Eastwood. Yet the finger is still pointed at him and American Sniper. And the bloggers have attacked Eastwood in his movie because they're angry about Selma's snub. But now that that snub is moot, because neither were nominated for Director, and both, mind you, were nominated for Best Picture. But they still don't want to take their finger off of Eastwood. So what happens when the thing that you're complaining about happening turns out not to actually happen? Now that Eastwood is no longer a viable point of blame, their focus is now on the American Sniper box office. It made some money, folks, and to the tune of $90 million in its opening weekend. So there's a finger pointed at American Sniper and a finger pointed at Eastwood, and now there's a finger pointed at our society for going to pay money to see this movie. A movie whose director was nominated for Directors Guild over Selma's, because that's where this all started. AwardsDaily.com posted this on January 18th in regards to the kinds of people that will go see American Sniper. From the middle of the piece, quote, "With Sniper, you're really seeing the silent majority speaking with their wallets. These are the men who populate this country who aren't really moviegoers at all, because they only pay to see movies with car crashes and lots of dead people. Sniper has it all. Prestige, war hero, shooting people, and the chance for Americans to feel like Americans, for better or worse." End quote. Awards Daily posted this just 2 days later. Quote, "The race is no longer very interested in factoring in public opinion along with critical acclaim, but rather it's reverted to something decided on by studios, bloggers, and critics." End quote. So if the Academy doesn't base their votes on box office or public opinion, then what does it matter who goes to see it? The last quote said that the Academy interest has reverted to bloggers. Well, what are the bloggers doing? They're running a smear campaign on American Sniper. And let's face it, folks, if American Sniper was released in the summer, we wouldn't even be having this conversation. Because since 2011, the month of January has been in the bottom half of all the months of the year when it comes to gross dollars at the box office. If American Sniper is pulling these types of numbers in January, then what does that say about how war-hungry our society is? So say the bloggers. But folks, these numbers would be par for the course in June. And I find it odd that with all the finger-pointing, there's not one pointed at Bradley Cooper, the star and producer of the film, and the individual responsible for getting the movie made. In case you haven't noticed, there's a double standard here. So the question is no longer which director is to blame for our movies getting snubbed. The question is now, how can so many people go see such an offensive movie as American Sniper? But the question I would like to pose to you is, is the crime going to see this offensive movie? Or is the crime blowing it out of proportion and causing people to talk about it, lengthening its reach and expanding its access? Who is responsible for all the American Sniper buzz and traffic and hoopla and box office sales? Unsatisfied pundits and Oscar bloggers, when they don't get their way, have to find something to blame, and with that comes the very reason they have something to blame. They generate interest. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. And this isn't new, folks. It happens again and again and again. So now we're back to the other side of the coin. There's this need to have a problem. And these bloggers dedicate their lives to following an award show and not only allow themselves to be disappointed every year, but are responsible for creating a world in which it is not only possible, but very likely. And when you look back at all the blaming, it's like these bloggers are now looking into a mirror. Because from all the finger pointing, the only finger that matters, but the one nobody sees, is the one pointed at themselves.
he's got supporters. Detroit, New York, Los Angeles, inciting large-scale arrests and sympathy marches.
I'm very aware of that, Mr. Hoover. What I do know is nonviolent. What I need to know right now, what's Martin Luther King about to do next?
Mr. President, Dr. King is here.
Mr. President, in the South, there have been thousands of racially motivated murders.
We need your help, Dr. King. This thing's just gonna have to wait.
It cannot wait.
You got one big issue, I got 101.
Selma it is.
Here is the next great battle.
Selma's the place, and they ready.
Dr. King!
I tell you, that white boy can hit.
You will not tolerate agitators attempting to orchestrate a disturbance in this state.
It is unacceptable that they use their power to keep us voiceless. That have gone before us say no more.
People actually say they're gonna kill our children. They're trying to get inside of your head.
What happens when a man stands up, says enough is enough?
We built the path as we came, rock by rock.
His cell is probably bugged.
It probably is.
So Corey, you mentioned Selma. You framed a little bit of the discussion in terms of the controversy surrounding it, related to how Ava DuVernay's film depicts former President Lyndon Baines Johnson and his, let's say, reluctance to pass legislation or even support Martin Luther King Jr. and the civil rights movement as it led to the Voting Rights Act following all of the events that transpired in Selma and throughout the rest of the South and the country where this kind of prejudice was taking place. So you and I have both seen this. This movie finally went wide and came to Alabama. It took its time, but it's here. And this movie seemed to have a head of steam going into award season. Everybody seems to like it who has seen it. Yet, it has these detractors who have brought up this problem with the movie taking its own artistic liberties in how it portrays the former president, whom his supporters claim was adamant in his support of civil rights and made it a point to be a public supporter and pass legislation as soon as he took his oath to become the president of the United States. Ava DuVernay and others don't see it that way and see Lyndon Baines Johnson as more of a reluctant hero and supporter of the cause. Did that affect how you viewed this movie or how you experienced this film, Selma?
Well, I just want to say that I saw the film before Christmas, long before this controversy kind of erupted. It erupted right after Christmas, if I recall correctly, or maybe it came around before, but didn't really get the head of steam that it eventually got until later. So my viewing was sort of unclouded by all of that. I can't speak to whether that would have affected how I viewed it, but I have to think no, because I think DuVernay's portrayal of Johnson is more complex and favorable than the detractors, most of whom have not seen the film, seem to suggest that it is. I think reluctant hero is a good way of looking at it. And I think Johnson, as portrayed in the film, was, I'm all about what you were trying to suggest, but I've got other stuff I want to do first. And the rejoinder to that from Dr. Martin Luther King and his supporters was, we can't wait, so we're going to go ahead and start doing this, which tipped Johnson into action.
We're going to force your hand.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't see how that's such a controversy, except, I mean, it opens the door to interpret that on some pretty icky interpretations, which is, are people upset that history was not necessarily driven by the actions of a white guy? Like, you can't even give the civil rights movement and everything that it accomplished, you can't even give credit to the African-American men and women who sort of drove that engine. You have to say, well, they were down there marching, but really, our white president was the driving force
right
behind
well,
it. And that just feels like gross.
It's complicated because, again, it's not just any white guy. It's the president of the United States. And this film acknowledges that Martin Luther King and this movement, they needed his help.
Sure.
And they got it. And like you said, I think the movie should be read as a favorable depiction of Lyndon Baines Johnson.
I don't see how it can't
right
be, honestly.
Because this is, throughout the movie, he's acknowledging constantly, I know you need my help, and this is a big deal to me too, and this is something that needs to get done. But right now, like you said, there's a lot on the agenda, and I'm going to have to get to it later. And Martin Luther King simply says, well, it can't wait. We're going to go through with this anyway. And obviously things played out the way that they did. But for the most part, with perhaps a couple of exceptions, especially in the Wilkinson portrayal, I see a sympathetic figure and somebody who wants to do this, but has his hands tied and can't in the moment. I can see also how people might read it as villainous at times, just in terms of some of the language and the fact that he is sort of in the way of the cause in terms of being the most powerful man in America and the person who could move it forward when it needs to move forward, but doesn't. But it's probably with good reason, obviously, because the president does have a lot of fish to fry.
Well, you know, Johnson is ultimately such a small part of this movie that it is a shame that so much of the discussion has surrounded his portrayal, especially when Johnson was a complicated guy.
Yeah, well,
he was both a civil rights hero and, by many accounts, the sort of guy who would just drop racial slurs into conversation.
Which he does in this movie.
Yeah. So, as far as history goes, the debate around Selma is troubling, because it seems to be a largely white opposition saying our history is what matters.
Right.
You as an African-American woman, Miss DuVernay, if your history doesn't line up with our history, it's invalid. And that's super gross.
Yeah.
Especially, and we've been talking around this, especially because Selma is an excellent movie.
Yeah, it really is. And Ava DuVernay is an incredibly talented filmmaker who does not shy away from the extreme nature of the violence and just the heaviness of the moment and the weight that it had on the shoulders of so many Americans, especially these people who were actively involved in this specific movement in Selma, Alabama, and the toll that it took on them and the sacrifices they had to make for the greater good. She does an incredible job.
Oh, absolutely.
There are scary moments in this movie, especially at the beginning, that completely catch you off guard. This movie is not overly sentimental either.
No.
In its portrayal of Martin Luther King Jr., the fact that it was not scared to question the moral character at times of Martin Luther King in one crucial scene in the movie involving him and his wife. And I think she deserves a lot of credit for that. Because this movie could have been one thing, but it happens to be the other. And David Oyelowo, I think, got robbed.
Oh, totally.
Of an Oscar nomination. Totally. And if I've got to choose between him and Bradley Cooper, I'm going with David Oyelowo's performance, personally.
Can I kick out, like, Eddie Redmayne or Benedict Cumberbatch
Go
instead?
Ahead.
Yeah.
Go ahead. But I think let's acknowledge what it really came down to.
I know. It did. You're right. It did come down to one of them or the other. And
but again, that's a tough call. You mentioned gross. That's the gross nature of this whole stupid Oscar race. The fact that it forces you to pit these performances and movies against each other. And I feel like we go back to 2010 way too often, but it's the clearest example of why this is stupid, because of something like The Social Network, a movie that you and I are so passionate about, and we want to see win all these awards, and we want it to be considered by many as the best movie of the year, but this stupid, dumb, Weinstein-driven King's Speech comes in and ruins all the fun. King's Speech is a great movie.
Yeah, it's another movie we really like.
It's a great movie.
We both really, really like The King's Speech.
Exactly.
We both really like, for example, another film in that race, Christopher Nolan's Inception.
Yes,
or
exactly.
True Grit, or Winter's Bone, or The Fighter, or any of the other Oscar nominees, and so many movies that were not nominated for Oscars.
Right. So, you know, I hate to get beside the point, but Oyelowo and Cooper both give great performances, and it just sucks that we have to choose and whine about which one got in and which one didn't when they're equally great.
Yeah. No, I think it comes down to that.
But Oyelowo, in terms of capturing the spirit of Martin Luther King Jr., just the fact that there's finally a real feature film that has been made about one of the most famous historical figures in America, it's great to see that, especially as somebody who grew up in the South.
Yeah.
But he does a great job.
Oh, he's fantastic.
He, I think, captures, again, the spirit of the movement. And again, you talk about the nuance. This movie has a lot of it.
Right.
And it gets down to the guts of not only what they were doing, but the people who were doing it.
Yeah, you know, in that way, it reminds me quite a bit of my favorite film of 2012, Steven Spielberg's Lincoln, which is, it shows the complicated life of a deified historical figure, and it shows that when the going got tough and they had to accomplish the great things that they accomplished, they were not afraid to get down and dirty with the politicking that they needed to do to accomplish it. And Martin Luther King is quite the political operator as presented in Selma, having to navigate this sea of clashing personalities, having to choose the most appropriate battlefield, as it were, which turns out to be Selma, Alabama, because the sheriff in Selma, Sheriff Jim Clark, as we know particularly from Alabama history, is such a hothead who will be easily provoked to violence. The idea of picking Selma for that reason, to provoke violence unto nonviolent protest to get the attention of America. All of these considerations that went into this march and all of the conflicting organizers, such as the student organization who have been in Selma longer and are sort of resentful when Dr. King shows up with the Southern Christian Leadership Committee, you know, just navigating all of these personalities and sort of guiding them to eventually get along and find common goals. It's an extraordinarily complicated process that DuVernay and Oyelowo just nail it.
Yeah, you mentioned Lincoln, and I think that's a good comparison because you talk about people who have the same goal who see the method a little differently in getting what they want. This character, John Lewis, who is a congressman,
yeah,
is
one of the students in the film.
Yes, and amazingly portrayed by this actor. I don't know if it's Stephon James or Stephen James, but in what I think is one of the better supporting performances of the year. And I'm shocked that this and one other performance completely ignored.
The ensemble in this movie is just amazing.
Yeah, it's insane. That character reminds me a lot of Tommy Lee Jones in Lincoln.
Yeah.
Somebody who was doing something a certain way to get the same thing that Lincoln wanted in that movie, but acknowledges that this might just be how we do it. And even if we disagree with this guy and disagree philosophically with how we're going to achieve it, we got to go with it because we're all going to get what we want. And so it causes infighting within the movement, but you see the bigger picture. And to me, that was one of the better performances of the film. But also, is it Carmen Iogo who plays Coretta Scott King? She is outstanding.
Yeah, she is.
In the movie.
She's great.
And not to get hung up on the whole Oscar thing, but the fact that the field, especially in the supporting actress race, was so dry, the fact that her name never came up is ridiculous.
Yeah. Because she's outstanding.
She carries so much of the emotional weight of this movie and shares some of the most powerful scenes with David Oyelowo and obviously helps develop and give so much emotional depth to the Martin Luther King Jr. character and has plenty of independent scenes of her own that are so powerful. It just makes no sense to me that people wouldn't acknowledge this. Yeah, this movie just has so much going for it, but it seems like its eyes never get off of the prize. I mean, you mentioned, yeah, the ensemble is great. The music is fantastic, but I really think that other than the story itself and the fact that this seems to portray this movement and these events, honestly, DuVernay, to me, is just a real talent, and I look forward to whatever she does from now on. I want to go back and revisit Middle of Nowhere.
Oh, I do,
too. She's got chops, man.
I haven't seen Middle of Nowhere yet, but she working in tandem with the wonderful up-and-coming cinematographer Bradford Young captures so many indelible moments here, and the sequence that depicts Bloody Sunday on the Edmund Pettus Bridge is just an extraordinary directorial achievement. Just keeping that camera moving and finding what at times is unflinching brutality.
Yeah.
It's what's hard to watch. And yet to capture all of that with an unsentimental eye.
Yeah, the music too in that sequence is great. The way it's shot. And the performances, too, in that sequence are just
Wendell
amazing.
Pierce.
Physical.
And another pair of supporting performances I want to point out. Keith Stanfield from Short Term 12 shows up as Jimmy Lee Jackson, one of the martyrs of Selma, who is fantastic. And then the older gentleman who plays his grandfather, Henry G. Sanders, from Charles Burnett's Killer of Sheep.
Cager Lee.
He has this scene.
It's one of the best scenes of the year.
In the hospital with Martin Luther King. I mean, I knew when I started describing that you knew what I was talking about because it is such a singularly powerful moment in this movie where even the great orator, Dr. King, is left dumbfounded.
Yeah.
Sir.
Who? Not King.
found no words to soothe you, Mr. Lee. There were no words. But I can tell you one thing for certain. God was the first to cry. He was the first to cry for your boy.
Yes, happily dead.
He can't find the words to say. It is just magnificent.
Yeah, and what he says there about his grandson, you mentioned the guy who was in, the young man who was in Short Term 12, gave a great performance in that, and I always look forward to seeing what he would do next. And his follow-up is just outstanding here in what his character obviously represents. But within that scene itself, and obviously having to take a moment with someone who has suffered the violence that has been such an enormous part of this whole experience and this whole movement, it's just, it's extremely powerful, and it's due in large part to the performance there by that actor Henry G. Sanders, who is amazing. In the moment, I wondered, is this guy like even really an actor?
I recognized his face,
yeah,
and he pops up in things now and again, but yeah, he's just extraordinary.
For sure. So Oscars aren't important. You know, we care about them just because it entertains us. It influences us to
horse
form.
Race.
Yeah, it influences us to form our own list and acknowledge what we consider our favorite things of the year. So in the larger scheme of things, they don't really matter. And people who are so angry about Selma's absence and only getting two nominations, I think the fact that it got Best Picture is a huge win, and I'm glad that they at least acknowledged it in that category. But it doesn't mean that Selma is any less of a great movie, and the people who get so hung up on it and angry about it just need to take a minute and acknowledge that, wait, this movie is great. Let me watch this movie and recommend it to people and write about it, how it makes me feel as a filmgoer and its importance in the year 2014 to me, then I think you'll get more done if you focus your attention on the positive aspects of how much of an impact it had on you, because it leaves a great impact on you.
I mean, I will admit, you know, to being a little angry. It is frustrating when so many talented artists like Ava DuVernay, like David Oyelowo, like even Bradford Young, whose work in this movie is comparable to somebody like Gordon Willis. It's frustrating when these artists are not validated, or you don't see that they are validated. And it's frustrating that they have not received that level of personal recognition for their contributions to what is an extraordinarily moving piece of art. But I mean, ultimately, you're right. I think this movie's going to have a legacy because of how clear-eyed it is, how deftly and sensitively it tells this historical story that needs to be told.
Yeah, and this is a movie that will be shown in schools for years to come. I mean, no offense to The Imitation Game or Theory of Everything, but I'm guessing 30 years from now, the movie people are going to be talking about is Selma.
I mean, I plan to show it to my students.
I like The Imitation Game.
Yeah, it's fine.
Yeah, I think it's a good movie, but it's not as close to me personally.
Right.
I obviously wasn't around in the 60s, and you know, I wasn't a part of the civil rights movement, but this is about my home state. These are places that I have been. This is something that has been a part of my history as I have grown up here, even in Tuscaloosa. So it has an extreme amount of importance to me personally that somebody would take the time to not only acknowledge the history, but also depict it in a feature film. Again, something that I am personally passionate about. So I hope we see more of these. But I just think DuVernay deserves a lot of credit. And again, the ensemble is so great, and just the depiction of it. It's one of the best movies of 2014 for sure.
Hands
it
down.
Should have been acknowledged. The people who are in it and the people who made it should have been acknowledged. And the more important thing is that it's acknowledged by us. It's acknowledged by the people who see it. And
by
the people,
Aspect Radio.
Well, I just mean by the people who appreciate it. The people who don't care and don't get hung up on these so-called historical inaccuracies and the artistic license that somebody like DuVernay takes with it to tell their story. And maybe she did, and we don't know the full history. I admittedly have to brush up on mine personally as it relates to Lyndon B. Johnson, but the movie itself, it entertained me.
It's terrific.
Like American Sniper did, too. I don't have a problem with artistic license for either film, Corey.
American Sniper entertained me, but as a piece of art, it is certainly lacking in many ways that Selma is not.
So, but I think what's more important here, Corey, is when you think of the year 2014, do you think of now American Sniper versus Selma?
No. No,
you think
I don't.
Will?
No, I don't. American Sniper will probably owing to its stunning success at the box office, be remembered as one of the more important films of the year. But these dichotomies, these rivalries hardly ever last past the Academy Awards. I mean, I guess that you and I, people like us, will still think of The Social Network versus The King's Speech. But, you know.
And neither of these two are winning Best Picture.
Right. That, I mean, what it comes down to is that's true. It's still Richard Linklater's to lose.
Yeah, I feel like Boyhood is just kind of sitting in the corner laughing at the hubbub.
So you go and make your money.
Right.
I'll be over here being an artistic achievement for the ages.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Psst. That you, Shasta?
Thinks he's hallucinating.
No, just a new package, I guess.
I need your help, Doc.
You know, I have an office now. That's like a day job and everything.
I looked in the phone book. I almost went over there. Then I thought better for everyone if this looks like a secret rendezvous.
So, somebody keeping a close eye?
Just spent an hour on surface streets trying to make it look good.
So, before we go here, Corey, let's not fall into this rabbit hole too deeply, but you and I both also saw Paul Thomas Anderson's new film, Inherent Vice.
We did.
Which is his adaptation of the writer Thomas Pynchon's novel of the same name. I haven't read the book. Have you?
I've started it.
Okay.
You know, it's as dense as the film.
Right. So I'm not going to waste time explaining what this movie is about.
Oh, because I've got it.
Okay.
Would you like me to explain?
Yeah, do.
I don't.
Okay.
I'm kidding.
So other than to say that it's about a burned out hippie private eye trying to solve something, and not even he really knows what that is.
Something, everything, yeah. And or nothing.
Exactly. Is that pretty much how you felt about it? I mean, do you know how you feel about it? Have you seen it?
Yeah, I do.
Have you seen it one time?
I've seen it one time.
Okay.
But unlike Anderson's previous film, The Master,
yeah,
which I needed a second viewing to truly sort of crystallize my feelings on, I walked out of Inherent Vice certain that I had just seen a masterpiece.
I think I feel the same way. I need to and want to see it again.
I want to.
But this is a movie that just has such a strange impact on you as you're watching it, and once you leave the theater, just as many people who hated The Master are going to hate Inherent Vice.
Yeah.
Maybe even more so.
Probably.
Because you're watching it and you're like, what's going on here?
The plot is...
What just happened?
The plot is irrelevant. Because the plot... I mean, but the thing is, like, I don't think that the movie even ever suggests that the plot is going to make sense. Because even Joaquin Phoenix's character, Doc Sportello, as new red herrings and subplots and characters are introduced seemingly every scene, basically always has this look of clear befuddlement on his face, or has a line of dialogue that's like, wait, what now? I mean, I don't think that the movie ever even hints or seems to indicate that anything about it is going to make sense.
Yeah.
So if you go into it expecting that, then the sort of mood and the sort of thematic work that Anderson is doing is really quite something.
Visually and just technically, it's as on point as ever for him, and it's just an amazingly concocted experiment of a movie that's also hilarious and wholly accessible and you know, for much of it. But not to throw like somebody I know under the bus, because he probably knows I'm referencing him, but once they saw it, and again, this is someone who also acknowledges that it's gotten better since I've seen it, and the more I've thought about it, and I need to see it again, but the way they referred to it was light PTA, like it's lighter PTA.
No.
And, you know, with respect, I couldn't disagree with that more. To me, this is one of his heavier movies, and there is so much emotionally invested in this. And for me, it's so interesting because when it boils down to it, regardless of what all happens, because a lot happens and it's hard to really sort of put the pieces together, and I'm not sure that you're really supposed to. But more than anything, this is about the lengths at which someone will go for someone that they really care about. And in this case, an ex-flame that still holds a lot of importance to this person, and what they can do to get that person back or reconnect with them in a way that is important to them. Broken people on both ends of that relationship. There's a sequence late in the movie that tells the entire story. And it's a really unusually shot and performed scene. But there's this sort of climax within the scene, so to speak, that just hits you like a ton of bricks.
Yeah, it does.
It shows you just what kind of people and what kind of feelings we're actually dealing with here. And really, you start to think about the rest of the movie and why this person has behaved the way they are, why they have become the kind of person that they are. And you start to understand, oh, okay, I get it now.
And more broadly, it is about attempting to reconnect with things that are impossibly out of reach. Wanting to have something that is impossible to have. All of these characters, almost to a person, are yearning for something, either from their past or something that might represent a different sort of lifestyle that they have never lived and will never live, such as with Josh Brolin's character, with Reese Witherspoon's character.
Yep.
Or just generally, it's almost an elegy for the passing of time and the sort of disappearance of Doc Sportello's hippie lifestyle as the 60s turn into the 70s. It's not insignificant that that's when this film takes place. And the flatland people, as Pynchon and Anderson describe it, the squares, the normal people, are just creeping ever inward toward this safe haven. It's there's no escaping from those, I think, as Joanna Newsom's voiceover puts it, those ancient forces of greed and fear of American capitalism and this culture of wanting more and always wanting something else that has permeated the souls of virtually all of these characters.
Absolutely. There's a scene towards the end of the movie involving the Josh Brolin character that is absolutely amazing.
Yes.
And again, it's another moment that sort of tells the whole story in a way. Like you said, the broader picture of it, this square mentality, sort of letting go of this wholesome American idealism. And instead of preserving that, really pretending to protect it, it's like giving in to the subversion and the counterculture.
In a hilariously stupid way, yeah. Too. And giving in just like
way. There's nothing they can do about it.
Right.
And it's just happening. And the way he gives in, it's like how everybody should or maybe wanted to. And it's an amazingly hilarious and thoughtful moment.
Yeah.
And Josh Brolin is hilarious.
Everybody is hilarious in this. This talk about a great ensemble.
Oh my God.
We mentioned that with Selma, but this film is chock full of people who just even sometimes show up for one scene and just do something completely ridiculous and hilarious, like Martin Short.
Yeah.
Or like Eric Roberts. Or so many of these people who just show up and just act completely ridiculously.
There's dialogue and there are things people say and things that happen that make so little sense as they're happening. And there are just these moments from the point of view of the Doc character, and you can't tell if he's hallucinating or not. And the same is true for you, the moviegoer, and you just kind of have to go with it and experience it as Doc does it. I mean, in some cases, it's confusing. In most cases, actually. But when it makes sense to him, it makes sense to you.
Yeah.
So Andersons are 2 for 2 in 2014.
I agree.
Yeah. So
3 for 3 if you count Pompeii.
I do.
It's a trashterpiece.
How could I forget? Inherent Vice is still playing in Birmingham right now. American Sniper's playing everywhere. Selma's playing everywhere for the most part. But I guess for the sake of time, in the order you should see those, if you want to see all three, Inherent Vice should probably be first because it'll be going away soon.
Yeah, I agree.
And it's up for a couple of Oscars, too. How about that?
Yeah. Screenplay, that nice that it snuck in there. And also the costumes, which are a really great element of that movie.
Yeah, pretty awesome. You don't see many 70s set movies getting costume nominations.
But so many of the costumes are so weird, again, just to fit with everything else that's so weird in this movie.
Yeah, totally. Okay, well, before we go, I think we are going to hear from another friend or two from the Film Nerds crew.
Hey guys, it's Ben Stark with Wonder Mill Films in Huntsville, Alabama. Just wanted to call in and talk about American Sniper real quick. I haven't seen the movie, so I have no opinion. I have no thoughts about the movie. And I have nothing to say about the movie. Maybe I will once I see it. All right, guys, that's it. Thanks for letting me call in. Be sure to follow me online at twitter.com/WonderMillFilms or WonderMillFilms.tumblr.com and keep up with my short film work at BenStarkFilm.com. Thanks again. Bye.
For Film Nerds and Aspect Radio, this is Graham Flanagan in New York. Every year, it feels like the Oscars get something wrong. couple of the standout snubs for this year include the Lego Movie for Best Animated Feature, which I still have yet to see. It seems like conventional wisdom says that it should have been in there. And it's hard to take the Oscars that seriously, especially with their legacy that includes failing to honor people like Stanley Kubrick with a Best Director Oscar. Same goes for Alfred Hitchcock. Also, Gordon Willis never won Best Cinematography. So you have to take it with a grain of salt and take into consideration the amount of politics that play into what films get recognized every year. But I have to point out what I feel is work that should have been recognized, and that's from the Australian movie The Babadook, one of my favorite movies of the year, one of the best horror films I've seen in a long, long time. I'm not a big horror guy, but I felt like this just nailed the genre. It was a fresh, original take and was absolutely terrifying. I did indeed have a nightmare about the movie the night after I saw it. And I think that two key performances should definitely get recognition, those being the two leads in the film, Essie Davis and Noah Wiseman. Two just fantastic performances. Davis should, I think, win the Oscar for Best Actress. She is just unbelievable. And Noah Wiseman delivers probably the best child performance we've seen in years, even better than Danny in The Shining. I mean, this kid just steals the movie. So it's a great film. It's on demand and on iTunes. I highly recommend watching it. I watched it during the daytime, which was a compromise to the person I was watching it with. But watch this movie at night and tell me you don't have trouble sleeping. It's The Babadook. Check it out.
Check us out on iTunes. Hit us up on Twitter at Aspect Radio. Same on Facebook. Go to aspectradioshow.com. You can hear everything. Read Corey's stuff on artsbham.com.
Yeah, I just got a review of Cake Up yesterday, the Jennifer Aniston film that would have been an Oscar contender, except that it's terrible.
And read my stuff on al.com. Thanks, as always, to our producer, Andrew Richardson. And until next time, I'm Ben Flanagan.
And I'm Corey Kraft. This is Aspect Radio. Thanks for listening.
Any day now, I will hear you say goodbye, my love.